Welcome back to Pod Save the World. I'm Tommy Vitor.
I'm Ben Rhodes.
Ben, did you see that Jared Kushner got a New York Times book review for his book? Did you pick up a copy?
I did not pick up a copy of the book.
Okay.
But I definitely picked up that review more than once.
Was that the best review you've ever read?
It was like tied for first with a notoriously savage takedown of Guy Fieri's Times Square restaurant. I don't know if you remember that.
I remember that. Yeah. Although in hindsight, I think Guy Fieri is like a very nice guy.
Yeah, it was
that
so
person just looks like a huge asshole.
Yeah, it was so mean. He had to go on like the Today Show, I remember, the next day to do cleanup.
The author did?
No, Guy. Oh. And I will say that he, do you remember we had guest chefs at the mess in the White House?
Oh, yeah.
The carryout window. So at the carryout window, you'd get these, you know, guest kind of B-list celebrity chefs.
Sure.
And you would never see them. They cook, but it was
hard
nice.
Shot at Sam Cass.
Guy worked the window.
Oh, you went to Flavor Country in the White House.
I went to Flavor Country in the White House with Guy. Very nice guy. Very nice guy.
So, yeah, frosted
tips. I don't know how
we got
into that, but yeah.
I mean, basically just makes a big burger and he loves it. And it looks...
The food is very large. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a lot of food. Yeah. We got a great show today in top of our culinary takes. We're going to cover the latest news on the raid at Mar-a-Lago. These idiotic attacks against our queen, Sanna Marin, the prime minister of Finland.
Yeah.
Some reports that Colombia is considering decriminalizing cocaine. A UN report says that forced labor is taking place in China. The presidential election in Brazil, political unrest in Pakistan, Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas makes news in maybe the worst way possible.
Yeah, yeah. In the worst place, too.
We'll explain why.
Wait for it.
Saudi Arabia gives the United States and the entire West the middle finger. Dennis Rodman, French go-karts, dumb Starbucks, and mountain Wi-Fi.
What a week.
What a week. Ben, yeah. And then I talk with Max Seddon from the Financial Times about this mysterious bombing outside Moscow over the weekend that killed an ultra-nationalist Russian TV pundit who was the daughter of an influential and very, very frightening Russian philosopher slash like
kind of Rasputin
cult leader.
Yeah,
he's really kind of like a genocidal
lunatic
maniac.
And his daughter was, you know, the apple didn't fall far from the tree on that one.
Yeah, and she was on, you know, like the Russian propaganda networks that go 12 hours a day.
This is not a nice person.
It's very interesting. There's lots of theories about who did it, why it happened. But Max really points us at the response in Russia and the way Vladimir Putin is lifting up this event. I mean, none of us support like the assassination of anybody, let alone someone's kid. But it does seem like Putin wants to use this for as another pretext to do more awful things to Ukraine.
You know what I'd say, Tommy? If you want to listen to premium quality content about Russian assassinations.
Yeah, where could I find that? I've been actually on the lookout.
Yeah, you could find that. Episode 6 of Another Russia is coming up on Monday, and that is the assassination of Boris Nemtsov, which was, you'll hear us actually walk through in the next episode, the theory of who was responsible for the actual killing of Boris Nemtsov. Ultimately, Putin, we think, but let's just say Ramzan Kadyrov, the Chechen ally of Putin, makes an appearance. And the one that's out now is great. It does the backstory on the annexation of Crimea, Boris Nemtsov opposing that, going to Israel, debating leaving Russia, and obviously making the fateful choice to come back. So check out Another Russia.
Yeah, very important. Also, you know, there was another incident in Russia where Putin was essentially accused of a false flag bombing terrorist attack on a residential building.
Yes.
So this isn't the first time this stuff has come up.
Yeah, it sounds like crazy conspiracy theory, but if you look at the origins of Putin's rise to power, you'll find some false flag operations along the way.
Not a good guy.
Not a good guy.
We'll get to the news in one second, but there's less than 100 days till the midterms, Ben. Midterm madness. We're rocking. We're getting excited here. So you can find all kinds of new Vote Save America merch in the Cricket store. A portion of it goes to Vote Riders, which is the leading organization focused on informing citizens of their state's voter ID requirements and helping them secure the documents they need to vote. Cricket.com/merch if you want to look at the new merch, or just go to VoteSaveAmerica.com and you can find out how to get involved, to do your part leading up to this year's midterms. So if you want merch, great. But just check out VoteSaveAmerica.com. We'd love it if you could knock some doors and make some calls because it is important. All right, Ben, we're going to give the people what they want and give them their Raid-a-Lago update. So the story's been evolving like minute by minute. The New York Times says the government has recovered more than 700 pages of classified documents from Trump's country club basement. Last night it said 300 pages, so that keeps ticking up somehow. The Times says the volume helps explain DOJ's sense of urgency and why they did the raid. Yeah. I'd say so.
700 pages.
That's a lot. Yeah. That's not an accident.
It's like War and Peace right there.
Yeah, that's on Sandy Berger's sock.
It's not fitting in socks.
It's not fitting in a sock. The Times says DOJ was also worried that Trump and his aides were cavalier with the documents, lying about them. They said that Trump himself went through these documents in 2021, ostensibly to get classified information out. DOJ is also asking for more security camera footage from the area where they were stored. Apparently, some of the footage they already got shows people moving boxes in and out of the storage room, some documents being moved into different containers. I don't know why you'd be doing that. Courts are also deciding whether or not to release portions of the underlying affidavit used to justify the search warrant, and Trump's lawyers filed a motion asking for something called a special master to be named to essentially weed out documents in the cache that was taken by the FBI that are supposedly covered by attorney-client privilege. Lastly, Ben, we talked last week about this suggestion by Kash Patel and other Trump lackeys that he had a standing order to declassify documents when he took them home at night. It was self-evidently ludicrous. No surprise that 18 former Trump officials said as much to CNN.
Yeah.
So I don't know, Ben, the more we learn, the more this raid kind of makes sense and seems less extraordinary, especially people who are like moving the documents around in shady ways. I don't know. It's weird.
Yeah. I mean, a couple things jump out that are different than what we've talked about in the past with this volume of documents. And I think, I guess, I don't know if it's 300 documents or 700 pages. It's like a bit complicated, but
it's a moving target.
Look, 700 pages is a lot of pages. I mean, I had 8 years of access to classified documents. I had a safe in my office. You were in there. It was a SCIF. And I don't think I ever had like 700 pages at the same time, you know?
It's a long memo.
You just don't need all that. And so that's one point. The second point is the nature of the documents. I think you can kind of surmise something from the fact that there are 700 pages. If it was less, like the most benign explanation I could think of is, you know, these are a few classified transcripts of foreign leader calls.
Right.
Or these are, you know, a few memos he had.
The love letters to Kim Jong-un.
You love letters to Kim Jong-un, memos he had. No, if you're having 700 pages, like these are reports. You know, like these are like multi-page intelligence products that, as we've talked about, come from really sensitive sources of collection. And that's the other thing, the handling, what we've learned about the handling and the rumors that or reports really, that there are security cameras that show like these are an area of Mar-a-Lago where dudes are kind of wandering around and stuff.
Digging through.
You know, one thing we haven't talked about, we talked a bunch about classified material. You'll remember, Tommy, like even to just take a document out of the White House, let's say, and you're not supposed to take it home. I was not allowed to take classified documents home because my home is not a SCIF. It's not secure. Someone could break in and take the documents. But when you would travel, right? So say we're on a foreign trip and we have to go on Air Force One. Just to take a report out of the White House on a van to a plane where after you get to where you're going, you're going to put it in a secure room in the hotel, you'd have to carry those lock bags.
Those lock bags
sucked. These are these like big, heavy, like I don't know what these bags are made out of, but like the thickest possible, you know, material. And then like a lock on the top of the bag on this like intense zipper. You couldn't like cut this thing with like a, you know, a knife, you know? And, let's just say they spent 4 years under those protocols. Like even though Trump is a mess and, you know, maybe he's taking stuff back to the residence, he's in,
you follow
the, they're seeing the rules. Like they're seeing, we had burn bags in our office. So at the end of the day, you take all the classified documents, you print out that you don't need anymore.
That's what you call your toilet,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly. You put it in a bag and some dude in a uniform would come by your office in the middle of the night and pick up this bag and literally burn the literally burn it, right? So it can't be said just how extraordinary it is to just walk out with 700 pages, not have them in any kind of secure portable bag, have them lying around Mar-a-Lago. Like, this is just, it's not getting better for Trump. It's getting worse.
I just want to push back on this idea that these guys are cavalier with security, because Eric Trump posted a photo of himself doing a TV hit that included the Wi-Fi network name and password for the studio he was in. So I would suggest that the documents are in good hands.
He thought it was cool to, like, I mean, first of all, just the fact that that guy,
the password was like 112233.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's not much that guy can remember if the numbers get over like four. But
yeah, no.
He also was taking, I think, some picture of himself doing a TV hit.
Yeah, like a Tucker hit or something.
Come on,
Hannity.
Man. Like, what a
it's
loser.
It's not cool.
Yeah, it's like, we get it. You can get booked on television because you're a dad. But yeah, like, let's just say that the dudes that are literally posting their Wi-Fi password are not the people I'd want to entrust with the security of sensitive information.
Yeah.
I think if you've ever watched a movie in your life, you know that there are people that can pick locks. You know, I mean, come on, guys.
Yeah, come on, guys. Okay, next story. Many of you have probably seen the video circulating of Sanna Marin, the Finnish prime minister, dancing and singing with her friends. She is 36 years old. She likes going to music festivals. She likes dance with her friends. She likes other activities that, like, sentient human beings all seem to enjoy. Marin was pushed into taking a drug test after this video somehow came out showing her dancing, being a fun, cool person, because her critics suggested she was on drugs, which she obviously wasn't. Some thoughts on this, Ben. One, obviously, this is, like, just an exponentially bigger story because Sanna Marin is a young, attractive woman.
Yes.
I doubt that a video of Olaf Scholz, the chancellor of Germany, doing this would get as much coverage. It would get some coverage, though.
Olaf Scholz and Justin Trudeau posted on social media a picture of themselves having beers in a bar.
Okay.
And it didn't, you know, they're not taking drug tests.
It didn't do numbies.
It didn't get not a lot of likes on that.
There was a story that just came through the one of the crooked slacks about the new prime minister of Australia, like, slamming a beer at a music festival. And he was cheered. So there's clearly some unfair, unequal treatment here. Two, look, if I was her, I would lock down my social media presence and just not be in videos ever in the future. There's a lot of downside, no upside. But three, I actually think, most importantly to me, it's genuinely harmful if we penalize politicians for being normal and fun and social. Like, there's nothing wrong with going to a music festival or dancing with your friends or having a drink on a Friday night. On the flip side, I think it's actually really bad when the only people who get elected are the people who spend their whole lives, like, buttoned up, checking the boxes you need to check to get elected, asking everyone to delete photos of them from college, blah, blah, blah. Or, like, when normal people, like Sanna Marin, get driven out of politics because, you know, you can get destroyed. For, like, living your life.
This is a really good point. I mean, this really pisses me off. I gotta say, I'm very angry on behalf of Sanna Marin, and because you're right. Like, if a 16-year-old girl sees this and she's interested in going in politics, she's not going to want to go into politics anymore if she's a normal person, right?
Destroyed.
I mean, when I was 36, I think I was going to, like, your group house, you know, that you lived in.
1309.
Let's just say some things happened at 1309.
Whoa, what are we suggesting?
Fun
here?
Things. No classified documents at 1309.
Lots of beers.
You know, like, a lot of beers. I mean, but, like, and again, it's not like she was, like, you know, ripping lines of cocaine, you know, like, she was just hanging out, like, dancing and, like, having a drink. Like, this is normal behavior, people. Like, chill the fuck out and stop creating, like, it's beyond a double standard. This is, like, a quadruple standard.
Yeah.
And, yeah, like, what do we want from our leaders? Like, we could have Putin, who, like, stages, like, hockey games where he's allowed to score 80 goals.
He's sober, though, so great.
What do you think he does, by the way, in his, like, billion-dollar house, which had, like, a stripper pole in it, you know?
Right, it did.
Like, we know that there are actual leaders that behave in far worse ways. They just don't do it in public. The fact that she is comfortable having some of this on social media shows that she knows she's not doing anything that's, like, you know, illegal. like this is, I hate this. These
I hate
kind
it
of
too.
Things,
you know who else doesn't drink? Donald Trump. How'd that go for all of us?
Well, like
Didn't
the
it
last,
our lives?
You know, George Bush didn't drink. Mm-hmm. Well, he used to, but gave it up. I mean, would rather be she be sitting there eating a bunch of Big Macs? Like, I don't know. I don't like it. I just don't like it. I don't like anything.
I don't either.
It.
I hate the story. The story sucks. She seems young and cool and fun, and it sucks that her approval rating is going to take a beating because you dance with your friends in, like, an apartment. Who gives a shit?
And we talked about this. Like, one of the things that is missing in politics these days, and I'd say in this country too, is just, like, it should be fun, not grim, not buttoned up, not angry.
Some cool leaders.
Just some cool, fun
Obama
leaders.
Obama was cool.
Right?
You wanted to follow him. He was inspiring.
It was fun to work on the 08 campaign because it was fun, and he was cool, and he was normal.
Yes.
And if you disqualify those people from politics, you're going to end up with some pretty uptight people.
Yep.
And uptight people tend to do bad stupid
right.
things.
Right. No, people they target.
They're so repressed.
AOC yeah. seems fun and young and cool, and people think she's attractive. And what a surprise that she gets targeted and attacked and became like the number one boogie person for the right.
Well, yeah, let's be honest about this. Like, you know, it's entirely because of her identity, and that sucks.
I wish that she had told the people demanding she take a drug test to fuck off. Like, I guess.
What is that about?
When you know you, like, are going to pass it, I guess, who cares? Why not do it? But I hate the precedent. I really do.
It's also really stupid because, I mean, like, I don't know, Finns, you can at me if you want, but, like, I've been up there, like, seems like people are drinking a lot up there. Mm-hmm. Like was she just not allowed to drink like everybody else is? Like, I don't know. I had a lot of beers when I was in Finland. I had a good time.
I've never been. I'm going to check it out.
Helsinki, nice city. I was there at the White Nights. That was really weird. It was like I woke up and I'd had a few too many drinks, mm-hmm. more than Santa Marin had. And I woke up at like 4 a.m. It was like bright light in my room.
Nice. How's this for a transition? Speaking of White Knights, Colombia is considering decriminalizing cocaine. As we've discussed, Ben, Colombia recently elected its first leftist government, and President Gustavo Petro says it is time to accept that the war on drugs has failed and that Colombia should move from prohibition to a government-regulated cocaine market. Colombia is the largest producer of cocaine in the world, and according to the Washington Post, the source of more than 90% of cocaine seized in the U.S. The White House is not thrilled about this idea. There could be a big impact for Colombia in terms of drug trafficking, coordination, and cooperation with the U.S., aid from the U.S. to stop the drug cartels. So I don't know how this would really work in practice. I don't know if the cartels would fight it, right? Because they don't want their money and their power taken away from them. But it's hard to think of a more objectively true statement than the war on drugs has failed.
Yeah.
Of course it has. Yeah. That's true in the U.S., but you know what's really true? Colombia.
Fucking Colombia,
where people get shot. They literally get killed. Thousands and thousands of innocent people get killed. Because down there, the war on drugs is fought with guns.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, so
not
this
Reagan ads.
Well, and this came up like this. Yeah,
Nancy Reagan.
Remember those ads? Like, do you remember that ad when that guy walks in and he finds this kid with drugs and he's like, "What is this?" And he's like, "You, Dad, I learned it from watching you."
That is the best one. I learned it from watching you. Like what?
That was on for years.
Marijuana.
This used to come up at the Summit of the Americas and in Latin America in the Obama years, where other left-leaning leaders down there would kind of try to put legalization on the table, and the U.S. would always oppose it, and we'd leverage. And I didn't like that. I was actually like interested, at least, in this idea. It's at least
worth, talk about it.
It's worth talking about because if you like think about the experience of Colombia in the war on drugs. So we basically impose on them their drug laws, right? So we used to make them spray the coca fields, which mm-hmm. would then piss off the farmers, who would then become potential recruits for the left-wing insurgency, the FARC. Because we make it illegal, these drug cartels grow and they become totally corrupt force in Colombian politics. So you get like Pablo Escobar, like owning the government. Meanwhile, all the demand for the drugs is from the U.S., right? Yeah. So we like...
And all the guns
come from the U.S.,
down.
Right?
Yeah.
So we impose these laws on them, and then all this money that flows into Colombia illegally, so it can't be taxed by the government, goes to the cartels, who then corrupt the politics and then kill people with the guns that they bought from the United States.
Yeah, great system.
If I was the Colombian president, of course I would want to look at legalization. And we should try to engage them in a conversation about what that would look like instead of just kind of reflexively reaching for our war on drugs frame that is kind of ravaged, huge swaths of Latin America.
By the way, I mean, we did the old tablecloth getting yanked out from under the dishes thing to all these countries on marijuana policy.
Yeah.
Right? And
yeah.
Now we're just growing it in California, selling it to ourselves, feeling great.
Yeah. Feeling really good about it.
I'm obviously a big fan of Joe Biden and his administration. I think his views on drugs are very draconian.
Just side note, the lack of marijuana legalization and decriminalization.
It's crazy.
It's kind of crazy. I mean, that's
why would we want to reach a lot of young voters who are leaving the Democratic Party?
Why would we want to do something that it would be immensely popular with young voters in the midterm madness 100 days until the midterm?
And self-evidently a good idea, in my opinion. Also, in the process, maybe we could regulate some of these edibles.
Yeah.
So, Maureen Dow doesn't get like dropped on her ass by taking too much in Aspen or whatever. You know, we could fix all these problems. Staying in the region, Ben, talking about a neighbor here, let's talk about Brazil. So we're about 6 weeks away from the presidential election in Brazil. That will pit President Jair Bolsonaro against the former leftist president Lula da Silva. Lula's been leading the polls, and many people are worried that Bolsonaro sees this and won't accept the results. Bernie Sanders has been sounding the alarm about this for a while, and is a reportedly circulating resolution that says if Bolsonaro loses but tries to stay in power, the U.S. shouldn't even recognize the government or provide any military aid. Very interesting. There were reports the other day about some Brazilian business leaders, like on a group chat or something, talking about calling for a coup if Lula wins. Bolsonaro's idiot son is saying things like, boy, we can't help it if there's violence, just like Trump couldn't help it if there was violence after their rigged election in the U.S. Like, hate to see anything happen to you. And they're also saying, like, voting machines can't be trusted, et cetera. So the stakes here could not be bigger. Bolsonaro, he's a right-wing authoritarian. He openly pines for the days of a military dictatorship in Brazil. It's a huge economy. It's a huge trade partner. Like, the climate change implications are massive. So I don't know. Obviously, it's an election we should watch. The first vote is on October 2nd. No one wins a majority. The next one will be a runoff on October 30th. I read about this Bernie Sanders idea coming in. I don't know if you'd heard about it or have any thoughts.
Well, I think, first of all, this is really worrying for the reasons you cite. It just in the same way that stuff feels to be like going back in time in other, you know, parts of the world, right? Mm-hmm. Like, we got a war in Ukraine. We got stuff that feels like, you know, we'd put it behind us happening in lots of places. You know, fascism in Europe and Hungary. A right-wing military dictatorship in Latin America, something we thought we'd left behind.
Yeah, and it seems bad.
If that happened in the biggest country, over 200 million people, as you said, with massive Amazon climate implications, among many other things, that would be very bad. I think we're seeing that the Trump example does travel, right? And so there's this question of, like, are we, you know, just this kind of eccentric, weird, dysfunctional place right now? Or are we kind of connected and stuff that happens here can leap to other places? We've talked a lot on this podcast about how it does. Bolsonaro's language is like, literally, it sounds like Donald Trump. And he's always been the guy of these kind of, you know, blowhard nationalists who was kind of the most like Trump, like modeled himself the most on Trump. His last campaign, his first campaign, drew a lot of messaging and strategy and social media strategy from the example of the 2016 Trump campaign. And now you hear him talking about, like, rigged elections and bad voting machines and fake fraud.
Remember Jason Miller and Trump goons went down to Brazil to meet with them.
I'm sure Trump has probably got an endorsement coming for the guy, you know. So this is bad, and this is like Trump and Stop the Steal stuff traveling to another place, which is embarrassing to see as an American. And yeah, I think that the stakes are so high that we should make clear, because what you don't want to get into a situation is Bolsonaro basically tries to steal this election, and the question will be, does the military go with him? Because the other thing I'd say is, like, why wouldn't he do this? He keeps saying he's going to do
it. I know.
He's been saying for, like, since the beginning of this campaign, he's never been even close in the polls. That's clear. Lula's lead is not close. That it's rigged. You should expect him to try to do this.
Yeah, the question is if the institutions follow, right?
Do the institutions follow? Does enough of the military follow? And the U.S. should not fall into a situation where we're like, well, we don't think, you know, we there was fraud, but, you know, there should be investing. No, like, if it's obvious that this guy is running a play to just steal an election, we should make clear that our relationship with Brazil is entirely on the table, and try to get as many other countries in the hemisphere to follow suit. The fact, by the way, as we've talked about a lot, that the hemisphere has gone left means it's going to be harder for some right-wing guy to get any support in Latin America.
That's absolutely right. I do like that Bernie and Matt Duss and that team is mixing it up and kind of pressuring Bolsonaro from D.C.
Yeah, and I think
hopefully he won't be able to use it and twist it and push back. But, like, I don't know that anybody knows who
Bernie
is. No,
I don't think so.
There.
Yeah, the Lula people do, and they like him.
Yeah, they love him. Yeah, they do.
Lula and Bernie probably, like, you know, been hanging out for decades reading, like, Engels or something.
I bet they were picketing some, farm worker event labor organizing. In the 60s or something.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is why we like them both.
Yeah.
All right, we're deep in the dark section of the show right now, Ben, so get ready. So the UN Special Rapporteur on Slavery released a report saying that reports of forced labor in Xinjiang province of China, the Western China, are credible. Xinjiang is where the Uyghur Muslim minority has been brutally suppressed, and millions have been thrown into concentration camps for quote-unquote re-education. This report found that Uyghurs and other ethnic minority groups are likely have been forced to work in agriculture or manufacturing jobs. The Chinese government denies the report. No one should believe them. But Congress recently passed a bill, the Uyghur Forced Labor Prevention Act, that bans the importation of goods from Xinjiang unless companies can prove it wasn't made with forced labor. So I don't know. I just want to flag this one. Truly evil stuff happening in Xinjiang. And it really just, we've been talking about this for years now, and it seems like the international community has not found any real leverage to pressure China to stop it.
No. I mean, it's a good thing they do these reports. I mean, I know people can say rightly that the UN is fairly toothless, but I mean, who else is going to do a credible report like that? Yeah. I mean, you have human rights organizations, and that's really important. But it does, I think, matter that something with the kind of imprimatur of the
Rapporteur?
Yeah, the rapporteur, the imprimatur of the rapporteur,
that.
Right?
I like that a lot.
Puts this report out. The other thing that I think that the Chinese, from what I hear, and I have to look a bit more into this, are doing a bit of is they're starting to kind of strategically manufacture things that they know the world needs.
Good.
Like solar panels.
Oh, right. That's sort of why the Biden folks opposed it for a little while.
That's right. And the Biden folks had this problem because there's some material that comes out of Xinjiang province that is fundamental to the global renewables industry. So that's something to watch too. That's the cynicism of this. But I mean, I think continuing to spotlight it, try to isolate and sanction and target, obviously, any capacity to profit off of this forced labor. But yeah, it's bad stuff.
Bad stuff. This question, the shift to renewables is going to make getting sorts like rare earth minerals and all sorts of the cobalt, lithium, these things for batteries even more important than ever before.
Yeah.
And the Chinese will know how to exploit that. There was a report out of Sierra Leone recently about people passing a law that would require essentially local okay from citizens there before any sort of mining or manufacturing activity like that happens. It's going to be a big readjustment to see how the U.S. or the world really can get access to these rare earths without exploiting the populations and just destroying, local environmental, destroying the communities or making them unlivable, basically.
Yeah, no, I'm really glad you made this point. The Russians and the Wagner Group go down to Africa and try to control some of these types of resources. Mm-hmm. The Chinese do. And then also there have been some reports recently in places like Congo where, you get all these kind of individual miners because you can kind of go out by yourself and find cobalt. But then they get totally screwed because they have to sell this to a middleman who sells it up to some corrupt conglomerate. And these people are making $2-3 a day, even though what they're mining is worth a lot more than that.
Yeah.
There does need to be some part of the climate transition has got to be putting some regulation around this.
For sure. For sure.
Five years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Game day starts before kickoff. Get ready for the big game with help from Menards. Find great deals on sofas and recliners to keep guests comfortable all game long. Score big savings and stock up on game day goodies. Shop a variety of snacks and drinks to keep your party fueled up. Make Menards a part of your game plan. Shop in-store or on Menards.com and save big money.
Save big money at
Say big now during Menards Super Savings Sale. Brighten your home with a 3-panel LED light bulb. Now just $199. Stay warm with a hardwood firewood bundle. Only $399. Stock up with Clorox All-Purpose Cleaner. Just $299. A 16-pack of Zest Bar Soap is only $7.99. Hurry, these great deals won't last long. Sign up for Menards emails to get the weekly flyer plus exclusive daily flash sales right to your inbox.
Save big money at Menards.
Let's turn to Pakistan, because former Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan was charged with terrorism over the weekend, raising fears of political violence in Pakistan. Khan was pushed out of power in April, reportedly because he basically pissed off the Pakistani military, which is very powerful. But he's also blamed his ouster on a secret American CIA plot to push him out, which is No evidence of that.
Yeah.
So these terrorism charges happened after Khan threatened police officers and a judge during a speech. Khan is a former Playboy cricket star who is now a populist politician. He's holed up in his hometown. A bunch of his allies have been arrested or basically silenced. But Khan's popularity, as these attacks have come from the government, seems to be growing. His supporters are blocking access to his house, like physically with their bodies, so the government can't arrest him. He seems, you know, maybe he seems like a couple screws are loose. Yeah, Ben,
a bit of a megalomaniacal complex.
Yeah, but also the current government is clearly targeting him and his supporters in an extrajudicial way. Meanwhile, Khan's party is doing better in local elections. So again, like these efforts to silence him are backfiring. Pakistan has a long history of this kind of thing happening and the military and the police getting pulled into political fights in totally inappropriate ways. But it does feel dicey. You every once in a while, you remind like, oh, yeah, they have like, what, 200 nuclear weapons or something?
Yeah. I mean, first of all, there's a few countries where I always wonder, like, we talked about San Marin, but in an even more extreme case, like, why would you want to be the prime minister of Pakistan? Like you basically seem to end up in prison. You know, everybody kind of ends up getting charged with something in the same way. Like in South Korea, the same thing happens. Mm-hmm. Like every president seems to go to jail. But I mean, basically this is a case where, you know, Imran Khan, for a while he was in favor with the military. Mm-hmm. You fall out of favor with the military in Pakistan and this kind of thing ends up happening to you. You get the boot. They try to keep the lid on you. And you become more popular because people hate the corrupt military establishment, right? So this same
cycle
plays out. He is like, you know, obviously you don't want this to be happening. He's not the most sympathetic character either. You know, he like there's a lot of, I mean, even the plots of, you know, CIA plot charges and stuff, like it speaks to kind of like a bit of a narcissism, you know, like
totally,
you know, like everything is about him, like everybody's thinking about him. But yeah, to me, this just shows that, unfortunately, politics in Pakistan has not, you know, evolved in a positive way in the last 10, 20 years. It's the same as it's ever been.
Ayad Akhtar's book was so great in terms of talking, describing just how conspiratorially minded the Pakistani media and culture can be, too.
Yes.
And how you can imagine folding in this kind of narrative into a simple story of the military saying, hey, stop messing with us.
I mean, and we feed it because, like, when you have, like, you know, drones, it's easier to say that the U.S. is behind a bunch of stuff when the U.S. does a bunch of stuff secretly in your country, you know?
Yeah. So different story here about the Palestinian president, Mahmoud Abbas. He made news in the worst possible way last week during a speech in Berlin. Abbas expressed no regret for the attack by Palestinian militants on Israeli athletes in Munich, Germany in 1972. And he said that Israel had committed, quote, 50 Holocausts against Palestinians over the years. Again, this was, I think, a press conference with Olaf Scholz, the prime minister of Germany, in Germany, where you're not condemning a horrific terrorist attack and talking glibly about the Holocaust. We have been very critical of a lot of Israeli government policies or actions over the years. And people like Bibi Netanyahu, we've criticized the occupation. But I do think these comments from Abbas are worth highlighting, because they are despicable, and it's worth saying that. And they also just speak to the horrible predicament that the Palestinian people have been stuck in, where their ostensible leader is, like, at best powerless, at worst someone who would say insane shit like this, which damages his standing, damages the country, like, makes everybody worse.
Yeah, I mean, it's a disgusting comment given in the worst place. If he believes that, then he is just like a rabid anti-Semite. If he thinks he's like somehow appealing to some audience, he's appealing to like the worst audience in the world.
The worst people in
you
the
know,
world.
Like far right people in Europe, because he's in Europe or whatever. So that, you know, first and foremost, it's just gross. But then your point is so important, which is that like this also is like terrible for the Palestinians,
terrible.
Right? Like, because you know, you're going to Europe, ostensibly this is a place where Palestinians get a little more support than the U.S.
Right.
And these are the people that you're probably last remaining sources of, or some of your last remaining sources of diplomatic or development support. And this is what you do. I mean, this guy has to go. Like, he's like 150 years old.
Yes.
He doesn't do anything. He sits in Ramallah and, you know, does nothing to help his the people around him.
Yeah, he's street cred because he like hung out with Arafat in Tunisia
like,
back
yeah,
in the
he's
day.
Still hanging on to like the Arafat mystique. And look, it's just, you know, what, look, whatever you think about the circumstances for the Palestinians, I think everybody should agree. The Palestinians, anybody like who actually wants to see things get better, should want new leadership yeah. in the Palestinian.
Even progressive people. Israeli leaders who want someone they can actually negotiate with.
Well,
and
yeah,
get something
and
done.
Yeah, like the far right Israeli leaders are more than happy to have some like useless old guy.
Yep.
You know, so it's like it just plays into the worst of the status quo.
Yeah. Staying in sort of the Gulf here, Ben, I just want to quickly check in
yes.
on the impact of President Biden's visit to Saudi Arabia, how things are going, how they're being as a player on the world stage. Three quick updates. One, the Saudi energy minister said OPEC is preparing to cut oil production
yeah.
because oil prices are dropping too much. So they did not increase production.
Yes.
They're going to cut it. Two, a Saudi dental hygienist and mother of two was sentenced to 34 years in prison for sending what appear to be like pretty benign tweets about Saudi Arabia's human rights record.
Yeah.
Three, Saudi Arabia has executed 120 people in the first 6 months of 2022, double the total number of executions from last year, despite promises to reduce capital punishment. I will say we need to look in the mirror here when it comes to horrific executions and capital punishment because the U.S. is bad, but that is a god-awful number. So, Ben, seems like that fist bump solves a lot of problems.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the people that, like, were most annoying in the run-up to the visit, the fist bump visit, mm-hmm. were all the people who wrote, like, the op-ed pieces about, like, well, if you understood real politique,
yeah.
you know...
This is where the real men get serious.
Okay, like, idealists, you know, like, you think you live in this world where you can not deal with a dictator like Mohammed bin Salman, but we understand that in the real world, you have to go deal with him because he's going to do things like lower the price of oil, increase production, blah, blah, blah.
Machine gun the ceiling while yelling at his mom.
Yeah, well, that was all bullshit. Like, these arguments about realpolitik are absolute bullshit to cover up people that just kind of like to be on the take from the Saudis, right? I mean, they're literally working against the goal of lowering oil prices, which are down, as we talked about, because demand in China is way down because they have a crazy COVID zero policy, not because anything Saudi Arabia did. So that's the first thing, to just put a pin in the realpolitik crowd. And then if the realpolitik crowd, there's some overlap to the people who like to say that, oh, he's actually done some good things on women's rights, right? So part mm-hmm. of what you've heard
yes.
is like, well, you know, he may kill a bunch of people and, you know, shoot up the room with his mom and
he let women drive
and kill journalists, but he let some women drive. Well, he also just locked a woman up for 34 years for tweeting. So maybe hold the hot modernizer takes while you're at it too. I mean, it is what it is. It is what it looks like, which is like a brutal dictatorship run by a trillionaire megalomaniac.
Yeah. Absolutely. A few more quicker ones before we get to the interview. So we've talked many times about WNBA star Brittany Griner, her detention in Russia and efforts to get her home. Now, former NBA player Dennis Rodman says he is going to Russia to convince Putin to release her. Some listeners might remember that Rodman had a friendship with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. He visited North Korea a bunch of times. NBC News had a story about Rodman and this going to Russia. And it said Rodman called Putin cool after a 2014 trip to Russia. So I guess that's your credential. You will be shocked to learn, Ben, that Biden's team thinks that this trip is a bad idea and is more likely to hurt than help. It seems like there's a non-zero chance that Rodman could get himself in some trouble,
yeah, yeah.
if you ask me. Also, just, Ben, like, I just want to say, Dennis, like, if you're listening, buddy, you're not Michael Jordan.
No.
You are not the guy who we pass the rock to yep. at the end of the game and yeah. you put it on your back and you win. You're a rebounder.
Yeah, you hit the boards, man.
Right? Maybe the best ever. Like, play some team ball here.
Yeah. This is, you know, you and I usually are like, try whatever it takes, throw whatever against the wall and see if it sticks to get people out. This I would not put in that category.
Yeah.
It's one thing if, like, Bill Richardson goes over there. I mean, and Rodman, because, like, I don't see any scenario where Dennis Rodman goes to Russia and then Vladimir Putin lets Brittany Griner leave on a plane with him, right?
With nothing, because yeah. Rodman can't offer anything.
Yeah, he's not like he's
maybe
taking...
Maybe he can sign some
like
balls.
He's going to negotiate a spy swap over there, right? Or a prisoner swap. And then you can also see a scenario where okay, he could go and just kind of nothing happens. But you could see some weird scenario where like there's some photo op with Putin And he's kind of making fun of us. You know what I mean? Like, because like Rodman's this kind of weird dude. And I could see Putin using this in some, you know, it's not like it's an important way, but just like trolly.
Oh, the most cynical way possible.
The most cynical troll-like way possible.
Yeah, Rodman will probably get her out and we'll look stupid. But you know what? I'd love to look stupid.
I'd love to eat my words on this one.
I will eat the shit out of those words. Ben, have you ever seen, staying in Russia, have you ever seen the Nathan For You episode where he opens dumb Starbucks?
No.
Highly recommend that show.
I saw the real life version though, I think.
Okay, the real version happening in Moscow. There was an old Starbucks. It was shut down because Starbucks got out of Russia after the invasion of Ukraine. The Russians reopened it with a new owner, a Russian owner, apparently another rapper, with nearly identical branding, but it's just called Stars Coffee. And on the Stars Coffee website, they said, "Bucks left, stars have stayed." So you showed us.
Do you think it's like the full gamut though? Well, like, can they get the like those like bottled frappuccinos and stuff? I mean,
apparently they're selling
coffee.
Apparently they're selling booze. So they might have might be a real upgrade.
Yeah, maybe that's actually not a bad idea. It is a good test of how much that logo has been responsible for the Starbucks success, because it's quite a, you know, it's a logo that makes you want to go in and get a cup of coffee.
Yeah, wait till we sanction the shit out of like all coffee beans for no reason or something. This is a fun one out of France. The French Justice Ministry is taking some heat after inmates at the country's second largest prison were allowed to participate in like a festival of games that included go-karting and other games modeled after a French reality show. There's a video of this event, a competition, whatever you want to call it. It was hosted in the prison yard and it wound up on YouTube. The Justice Minister, whose name I believe is Eric Dupont-Moretti, called the video shocking. I watched the clip then and it looked fun as hell.
Yeah.
This guy was just tearing ass around the prison yard. Le Figaro reported that this event was approved at the highest levels of the Justice Ministry, but not the go-karting specifically. Prisoners raised 1,700 euros for charity, and the French officials said no prisoners involved in the games had been convicted of like violent crimes, like no rapists, no murderers, and there was no cost to taxpayers. So, I don't know, man.
What's the problem?
I think it's the dumbest scandal I've ever heard.
Well, do you notice this, like, in some of these European countries, you know, their scandals are so quaint compared to ours.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like we've got like a former president with like 700 pages of classified documents who tried to overthrow democracy in a violent insurrection. And they're like, you know, reading Le Figaro about go-kart racing in some nonviolent offenders prison. Yeah, sounds fine to me.
Look, admittedly, if someone like beat the shit out of me and took my money and then I saw him like go-karting around prison, I might be annoyed.
Well,
but it's not like
he's raising money for charity, right? Right?
Yeah. Well, also it's not like every other day is a good time in prison.
Yeah.
Also,
yeah.
God forbid that, like, I don't know, in the US, I think prisons abroad are generally better, at least
they're
in Europe.
Nicer, yeah.
We throw people into prison. We treat them like animals for years, usually for drug charges.
We radicalize them.
Yeah, and we expect them to come out and like reemerge reformed or with some humanity. No, like let them cart.
Just to merge streams here too, like there are not as many people in those prisons in France because they don't lock you up for life for like small petty drug offenses.
Yeah, three strikes, you're out.
So again, decriminalize marijuana for a start.
There we go. Last story. I wanted to mock this one, but halfway through I decided I was wrong. Mount Kilimanjaro, tallest mountain in Africa, is installing Wi-Fi so you can post stuff when you get to the top. You can get service right now at 12,200 feet. And it will be available at the 19,300-foot summit by the end of the year. Some of these reports were framed as like, hey, now you can post your selfie from the summit, you like vapid Instagram-obsessed narcissist.
Yeah.
And that's true. But there's obviously like a safety component. Probably be good to be able to communicate if you got like really sick. I did not know that there's also Wi-Fi and broadband at Mount Everest and has been for a while. I think it's more like 3G, 4G kind of stuff. The valid criticism is that Tanzania is installing internet on Kilimanjaro for tourists. But half the country doesn't have cell phone reception.
Yeah.
But Ben, guess who is helping build out Tanzania's fiber optic network?
I was going to guess like Elon Musk. But
the Chinese.
The Chinese. Okay. It was Elon Musk or the Chinese.
Yeah, the Starlink thing would be helpful.
Yeah, I think they would... quite possible that Chinese, like, there's some strings attached to that in terms of their access to data.
That's my guess, too.
But did you ever read The Snows of Kilimanjaro?
No.
The Hemingway story? Well, like, that's what happens. They get sick on the mountain and they can't, you know, so, like, actually the Wi-Fi would have been good for Hemingway, you know? But, yeah, like, it does speak to a bigger issue, which is that in sub-Saharan Africa, in part because there's not a lot of, in some of these places, there's not a lot of kind of physical infrastructure, like, you know, phone lines,
towers,
computers, towers. Everything, like has shifted to phones, right? So there's like mobile pay, mobile
right,
everything,
right? You kind of leap that step, yeah.
And that's a reason to try to expand as much as possible. And it's not that expensive.
Right.
It would be an interesting development finance priority for the U.S. We've worked a bit on like increasing access to power and electricity in Africa. Like maybe we can help wire Kilimanjaro. I don't know.
Like
or, you know, the places where people actually live and not just,
sure.
you know, tourists yeah, hiking and, you know.
Hemingway would have been good on Twitter, those short, pithy sentences.
Short and clear, but also they might have been...
He would have been canceled like that.
He would have been canceled. And they
stick
also...
Stick a fork in that guy.
Like, you know how he like kind of leaves things out? Some of them might have been kind of interestingly opaque, like, today I'm feeling quite fine in the cool air, and like nobody knows why,
yeah.
you know, or something.
He was just like a lame tweeter.
Yeah, it'd be a good... Someone should have like a Hemingway account, you know?
Was he a cocaine guy?
No, I think just booze.
Just booze.
A lot of booze.
Just hanging out yeah. in like Cuba, pounding booze.
One of the coolest things I got to do is I got to go to that house after I did the Cuban negotiations.
How big was it?
The Cubans knew I was like a big Hemingway fan. So they, you know, this is like what they can do. Like I got a private tour of Hemingway's house.
Cool.
It's like the coolest house, but it's like a house like designed for like drinking.
Okay.
You know, there's like...
How so? Tell me more. Like no stairs?
There's like, you know, like the place where he works is next to the place where his books are. And then it opens in this huge veranda where you can kind of just tell. And there's like animal heads on the wall. Huh. It's like a lodgy kind of feel. And they preserved it exactly as when he was there. There's a swimming pool where they used to have like wild parties and like Hollywood Whoa. Actresses would come down and swim in this pool. And then his boat is there that he used to take out. For like benders on the water, it's very cool. Like, check out the Hemingway House if you ever go to Havana.
God, can we just fix the stupid
Unfortunately,
Cuba
you're
policy.
Not allowed to travel to Cuba just, unless you have some like educational purpose. And you know, so
well,
yeah.
that sounds like one.
Sounds like it'd be good to go down to Hemingway House and check
Come
it out.
Come on, we did it, Joe. Just fix that part.
We did it, Joe. Legalize drugs and let people travel to Cuba
and stop talking to
and
Mom
don't talk
and
to Mom and Salman. Three. Solid recommendations to emerge from this podcast.
That's great. Okay, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, you will hear from the Moscow editor of the Financial Times, Max Sedden. We're going to talk about this car bomb in Russia that exploded over the weekend, killed a woman named Daria Dugina, the daughter of a propagandist herself. We'll also talk about sort of the general state of play 6 months into the war effort. So stick around for that.
Five years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all of your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments, so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hi, everybody. It's Andy and James here from your next favorite podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. We do fun facts.
Yes, we do. James, give me a fact.
Did you know that there is an extinct bandicoot whose official scientific name is Crash Bandicoot?
Lovely. I didn't know that. Did you know, James, that Upper Egypt is technically below Lower Egypt?
Incredible. Absolutely amazing. I would love to hear more about that.
Well, all you have to do is go and listen to No Such Thing as a Fish.
Where will I find it?
Oh, all over.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
I am so excited to welcome back to the show the Moscow editor for the Financial Times, Max Sedden. Max, it's so great to see you. How you doing?
Never a dull moment.
Are you in Latvia at the moment? Is that my understanding?
I'm in Latvia right now, yes. I have been mostly here these days.
Excellent, excellent. Well, let's start, you know, with a story that you've been reporting on from Russia, which was over the weekend there was this car bombing near Moscow, I believe, that killed a woman named Daria Dugina. A lot of people believe this assassination attempt was actually targeting her father, Alexander Dugin. Can you just sort of give us a quick overview of who these two are?
Well, so Alexander Dugin is a name that may be familiar to some of you. He's a philosopher and irredentist nationalist ideologue who is believed to have influenced some of the thinking underpinning Putin's invasion of Ukraine. He started out in the Soviet period in this bohemian dissident scene of writers. He became a big a Heidegger fan, was this self-taught philosopher, and then wound up developing these you know, both links with the European New Right. You know, those of you who are into that stuff will have heard of you know, thinkers like the French writer, you know, Alain de Benoist. You know, he was corresponding with them, and then gradually he started winning some fans in the Russian army and security services. So he wrote this book in 1997 that was on the syllabus of the Russian Army General Staff, the officers training course. He appears to have had some degree of influence over the thinking of, you know, Putin and the other ex-KGB officers around him who, you know, have been planning and carrying out the invasion. So basically, it's a sort of postmodern take on imperialism, where, you know, he argues that Russia needs to be this geopolitical counterpoint to the U.S. and reclaim control over its historic lands, you know, particularly Ukraine, and that Ukraine is you know, some sort of dangerous threat. So if you look at, you know, the way that he's written about in the press, there's a sort of indication that he was his close advisor to Putin. There's no indication that they've ever met. He was always extremely coy about this, including when I interviewed him once, and would never give an answer either way. I always suspected that the reason was because the truthful answer would be no to have ever met Putin. Right. But what was definitely true is you would see officials, you know, senior officials like Nikolai Patrushev, who's you know, Putin's maybe closest ally, the head of the Security Council. They would repeat a lot of ideas that came from fairly obscure points in Dugin's philosophy, like the notion of the world island, which is a big part of Eurasianism, which is, you know, the sort of umbrella that Dugin groups a lot of his thinking under. And so what changed in Russia, you know, even if he wasn't, you know, necessarily hanging out with Putin, you know, all day or indeed at all, what changed was he was saying the sort of things that, you know, by and large, you know, became more and more the political mainstream in Russia. And it was remarkable when you read the 5,000 word essay that Putin wrote last mm-hmm. summer, that was basically his manifesto for invading Ukraine, based off of his own historical research and you know, some weird books that he'd been reading that are well outside the Russian historical mainstream. You know, it almost read like Dugin could have written it, and, you know, Dugin would have taken that as a huge compliment.
Yeah, Max, this is an aside that is not the most astute point. I was a philosophy major in college, and I think that anyone who gets into Heidegger on their own is a sociopath. And you probably shouldn't do that, because that shit is dense and very, very impenetrable and difficult. I mean, I would describe, like, jokes aside, I would describe a lot of Dugin and Dugina's comments, his daughter's comments, as genocidal when it comes to Ukraine. I mean, didn't he get fired from a university job for talking about the need to kill Ukrainians? I mean, we'll talk in a minute about sort of his response to this assassination and the things he's calling for. But I mean, it doesn't sound like he thinks that Ukraine should exist in any way, shape, or form. No,
I think it's you know, maybe difficult to picture that, you know, this constituency exists in Russia, but really it always has. You know, there's some parts of the Russian elite who very much, like, even though they might have supported the war at the beginning, they thought they were going to have an easier time of it than they are, and they very much like it to be over and to get on with their lives. And there are other parts of the elite, and this is the sort of circles that Dugin and Dugina, his daughter, were in, that actually want him to go further. And if you think about it, it actually does make a difference, because you know,
of course, very much so. Yeah.
Do you destroy Ukraine? Do you destroy part of it? You know, do you kill 100,000 people, or do you kill 1 million people? Do you annex some of it, or do you annex all of it? Do you allow some sort of rump Western Ukrainian state to exist once you've captured everything east of the Dnipro River, or do you just basically completely wipe it off the map? And so Dugin, the way I have to understand these thinkers is that they're used by the Kremlin when there is the most use for them. It's not like the Putin necessarily read, he may have read something that Dugin wrote and decided to invade Ukraine, but these things are useful justifications. And so there was a point where in 2014 Russia annexed Crimea, and then they started the slow burning war in the Donbass in eastern Ukraine, and there was a while where it looked like they might annex it as well. There were a lot of Dugin buddies who were very heavily involved in that, chief among them Konstantin Malafeyev, the Orthodox Christian oligarch. And at some point, they evidently decided they weren't going to do that. And you saw some of these people like Dugin or Alexander Prokhanov, who will be familiar to readers of David Remnick's Lenin's Tomb. They've been on state TV a lot, and then they suddenly vanished. Dugin had this teaching position at Moscow State University, and he lost that after he said that Russia needed to kill Ukrainians. And
that was the quote I was thinking of.
That idea, but now it's very much back closer in the mainstream. And you should ask me a question first, but if you look at Daria, the reaction to Daria Dugina's death, she compared to her father, her father was still a fairly marginal figure in Russia, certainly not a household name, even if he did have some influence and pretty big reputation outside Russia. She was much less known than him, and only really at the beginning of her career, she was only 29 years old. And they very much could have let this one go under the rug. And the fact that they haven't done that, they effectively gave her a state funeral. Today we're speaking on Tuesday in the TV tower in Moscow, the Ostankino Tower, where most of state TV is broadcast from. And Putin gave her, there's no evidence that Putin had ever communicated with the Dugins in any way before Monday, when Putin sent her parents a telegram, and he gave her the Order of Courage, which is one of the highest Russian state awards posthumously. So Russia, the fact that Russia has started doing this, it certainly does indicate that there isn't really appetite for backing down against Ukraine. If anything, this has given a lot of fuel to the constituency in Russia that want to ramp things up even more against Ukraine.
Yeah, I mean, listen, so Dugin's statement said, "Our hearts yearn for more than just revenge or retribution. It's too small, not the Russian style. We only need our victory. My daughter laid her maiden life on its altar. So win, please." He also blamed the attack on the Nazi Ukrainian regime. I mean, just as a technical matter, it is true to say that, Dugin's also calling to put the whole country on war footing. Thus far, Putin has still clung to this idea this is a special military operation. He has not called up all the troops or whatever sort of technical thing he would need to do to have even more troops at his disposal. So, I mean, if you're going to sort of argue this is a pretext, okay, maybe it's a pretext to take that step. I don't know. I'm obviously speculating here.
I don't want to speculate too much because, unless you're the sort of person who really trusts what you hear from the FSB, we are unlikely to know anytime soon. You can make fairly compelling arguments in either directions. Ukraine has shown recently that it does have capacity to do attacks behind enemy lines. There's been in places like Melitopol and then Kherson and other bits of southern Ukraine currently occupied by Russia. There have been bombings and attacks and poisonings of some collaborationist officials, Ukrainians who are now working with the Russian occupation authorities in the Donbass in eastern Ukraine, the part that's controlled by Russia. A number of bombings over the years of the separatist leaders, and there's always been various finger pointing about whether the Russians or the Ukrainians could have done it. But what's You could equally make the argument that this might have been some sort of Russian false flag for whatever reason.
Right.
I don't need to remind listeners of Russia's history with state assassinations. The issue is that some students of history may be familiar with the murder of Sergei Kirov, who was one of Stalin's closest allies in the Bolshevik Party. It was obviously decades and decades before there was anything like evidence as to who killed him. This is still a matter debated by historians, but what was really significant was how the Soviet Union used the murder, and this is generally accepted as the event that set into motion the start of the Great Terror, when millions of people were killed and millions more sent to the Gulag. And I think that's what's significant here, because They could have swept this under the rug. The FSB claimed to have solved this one within 24 hours, and their version is just completely ridiculous, because it follows that the woman they're accusing of carrying out the attack is someone who is according to the FSB serving in the Ukrainian National Guard. Her info is already all over the internet, on various Russian hacker databases that you don't even need the dark web to access, and that she drove into Russia, was interrogated. They followed her on the video cameras that are all over Russia. They released footage of this, her supposedly entering the same apartment building where Dugina lived. No footage of her actually connected to the crime, and then after having supposedly committed it, she drove back to the border, which I've done. It takes 12 hours just to get there. It's pretty far with Estonia. Was interrogated again, and they let her through in her Mini Cooper. And the idea that they could have let this happen and then solved it so easily. We missed it. Why would we think of that?
Yeah,
it just beggars belief. But what's really important again is if you look at the funeral, I think it was really indicative of a process that has been happening generally with regards to the war. Is that this is the first time there's really been blowback against anyone in the elite from the war. There were people, you could go to Donbass or itself and get shot at or killed. There's obviously been a lot of economic blowback over the sanctions, but in Moscow life has largely gone along as normal for these people. And the idea that you can be blown up in one of the toniest suburbs west of Moscow is really shocking to a lot of these people, and they all know each other. It's a small town. Daria Dugina was on state TV a fair bit. They all run into each other in the green room. These shows go on for 12 hours a day these days, so they need the speakers. And what you're seeing is that a lot of people in the Russian elite, the sort of ultra-nationalist constituency, they're really losing their shame. And people who for years denied that Russia had anything to do with various nefarious acts they were accused of, now they're just kind of casually admitting it. So you look at Yevgeny Prigozhin was there, a man who had is in charge of the Wagner mercenary group that denied its own existence and now is advertising pretty openly. He's got billboards in Russia advertising, recruiting people on the internet. Prigozhin has, there have been some Russian media reports that even went to prisons himself to try to recruit prisoners to go fight in the war in Ukraine. There he is, posing for the cameras at the funeral with a Hero of Russia medal on his chest, Russia's highest state award of them all. You have Margarita Simonyan, the editor of RT, where Daria Dugina would sometimes appear. And she's saying, the supposed killers have gone to Estonia. If Estonia doesn't extradite them, then she made this joke about her own famous interview with the Salisbury poisoning suspects. We should send some professionals to go and admire the spires, and just kind of casually drops it like, we did poison the Skripals with a nerve agent. And it's like there's no point pretending anymore, because almost no one bats an eyelid, because it's like, we have a shadowy mercenary group that commits war crimes. Of course we poison these people. And the masks are off, as it were. I mean, there's no point pretending anymore at this stage. When you're, you know, this deep into the war, and when Russia, you know, there've been a lot of casualties, a lot of, you know, military losses, and a lot of economic damage. For a lot of people, the natural reaction is not to say uncool, it's to double down.
Yeah, I mean, so just to sort of button this one up, I mean, the Russians blamed Ukrainian for this attack on Dugina. The Ukrainian said, no, this was staged as a pretext for an assault on Independence Day, which is coming up on Wednesday. And then we have this former Russian member of parliament who got kicked out of parliament for opposing Putin. I think he now lives in Ukraine. He says a group of Russians that we're calling the National Republican Army were behind the attack. They're sort of, I guess, a dissident group. Is there any way to vet or understand this final claim that there's a new group that is, like, I mean, Russians who are anti-Putin within Russia? Is that sort of the gist?
Well, for a start to vet it, we'd have to have some sort of evidence that this group exists. And so far, the only evidence has come from this manifesto that Ilya Ponomarev read out on YouTube. And he showed about a 3-second clip of some guy in, you know, camo and with some, you know, bandana over his face and shades. You know, you can, you know, make out a single feature, you know, speaking through some sort of voice altering device. And, you know, it is true that there have been, you know, some people have firebombed recruitment offices. There have been some, there's been sabotage of railway supply lines and other things like that in Russia. But this particular group, there's no real reason, you know, at the moment to believe it exists, because Ilya Ponomarev is not exactly a trustworthy, you know, he's not really thought of as a trustworthy figure by, you know, even other members of the Russian opposition. He was, you know, in parliament for years, you know, voting for laws such as, you know, the Russian anti-Magnitsky law, which banned Americans from adopting Russian orphans. He had close ties to Vladislav Surkov, who was Putin's politics impresario for so many years. And then he voted against the annexation of Crimea. He went to opposition, and eventually he left the country after he was accused of various financial crimes. And I thought it was really telling seeing the reaction on Twitter just from other members of the Russian opposition when he said this, which was, you could sort of boil it down to thinking, you know, if I was going to start some sort of partisan group, and, you know, this would not be the guy that I would choose to tell people about it. You know, it only damages your credibility further. So, you know, you can spend all day doing this. You know, it was, you know, Colonel Mustard in the drawing room with the candelabra. While we don't have any real evidence, and, you know, the FSB is in charge of this investigation, it's only going to get you so far. And I think what's much more important is the reaction, and the reaction is very much showing that Putin and the Russian state are only going to, if anything, step up what they're doing to Ukraine
and use this that way. Yeah. You know, we've sort of talked about how this attack was one of the first times that the war has been felt in Moscow, certainly. There have been a bunch of mysterious explosions, drone attacks, whatever, in Russian-occupied Crimea, in the Crimean Peninsula, including places, you know, near where Russians were literally hanging out on the beach on vacation with their kids, with their families. Do you have a sense of whether those attacks and what I imagine was considered a relatively safe area have brought the war home in a different way for Russians, or impacted that broader narrative about the war? I mean, I guess this would be in terms of, like, media coverage, discussions you're seeing on Telegram, et cetera.
Oh, absolutely. I think there was certainly a feeling in Russia that, especially with Crimea, you know, they completely got away with it. They didn't have to fire a single shot, you know, when they were taking over the peninsula. You know, Western countries didn't really do anything. The sanctions were really mild, just a few sanctions against personal sanctions against members of the Russian elite, compared to, you know, the much, much more significant ones that Russia is under now. And, you know, they were able to, you know, heavily, you know, Crimea was internationally isolated, but they were able to link it to Russia, you know, with flights by building this extremely complex feat of engineering, this bridge that goes over the treacherous waters of the Kerch Strait, you know, built, of course, by one of Putin's childhood buddies at great expense. And there was a sort of, you know, feeling that, you know, they'd won, that, you know, people were going there having a nice time on the beach. You know, Putin's friends were buying up all the vineyards on Crimea. And this very much shattered that illusion. So this same bridge, the traffic going out of it has been at record levels since these military targets in Crimea started blowing up. And tourism in Crimea this year is down by, I think, half off the top of my head, which is partly because of the war. It makes it more difficult to fly there. This is not exactly a great advertisement for your Crimean beach holiday if things are blowing up at the airbase nearby. And it seems to have shown us that Ukraine, whatever these capabilities are, it's not entirely clear. It could be missiles, drones, behind the line sabotage, some combination of it. But they have some pretty good capacities, because some of these explosions in the places like Belbek Air Base near Sevastopol, that's about 300 kilometers south of the closest Ukrainian position. So it's certainly been impressive. And you get the impression that the Ukrainian government also really enjoy the reaction too, because as best as I can tell, it's their version of what Russia did when Russia seized Crimea and pretended for the first month or so that the little green men weren't really Russian soldiers, and which was just intensely irritating to everyone else, because
trolling.
You could see it with your own eyes. And so the Ukrainians, whenever there's one of these explosions, you'll see a bunch of senior officials in Zelensky's administration go on Twitter, and the joke is the thing for Russia, it's very embarrassing to admit that Ukraine has been striking these targets, and there's also the risk of provoking panic among the local population. You get things like people leaving Crimea en masse after these attacks ruined their beach vacation. And so Russia, for a long time, they wouldn't use the word explosion in state media reports. They just say some bangs or some claps. And the explanation would be, there was some sort of fire safety violation. The munitions just blew up by themselves. And so the Ukrainians would say, the Russians, they've been smoking again. The ammunition depot, shouldn't do that. Smoking. Yep. There's been a certain Schadenfreude built up over 8 years of occupation that the Ukrainians appear to be enjoying there.
Yeah, some dark, dry humor, but I agree with you. Sell your stock in Club Med Crimea. So last question here. Just, this war has been going on for about 6 months. Winter is rapidly approaching. Lots of European countries, notably Germany, are extremely dependent on Russian natural gas, which Russia is slowly ramping down, cutting off. There's all these maintenance efforts that suddenly have to happen, where the Nord Stream 1 pipeline shuts down for several days, comes back up, it's at lower capacity level. Do you have a sense of... this is a big sort of big picture question. What European resolve is looking like in terms of support for Ukraine as the cost begins to literally be felt by ordinary people who might have to, heat their house at a lower level, or industries that you could imagine might actually have to fully shut down if there really is insufficient natural gas supplies?
I think I was actually in Kyiv when the Davos forum happened, which was in the end of May. And I remember when there was a moment where the mood suddenly took a turn for the darker, because in Ukraine they'd been very successful in March and April at driving Russia out of central Ukraine. They were getting more support from the West. There was this feeling that they'd be able to do that. Life was going back to normal in cities like Kyiv, which itself, after what happened in February, March, felt to a lot of people like an act of defiance. And then a lot of Ukrainians in the elite, they came back from Davos having met all these European politicians and businessmen, saying, and you'd see a few of them say these things publicly. They have a Volkswagen was one of them, saying, we really want business as usual. And that's something the Ukrainians are very much worried about, and that's something that Putin pretty much appears to be counting on. So it's like a game of chicken, because something that Putin and the Kremlin have been saying a lot is that sanctions, they are a two-way street, because in Europe, especially in Germany, you had this this policy of energy interdependence that a lot of people in the West, they thought that this would somehow better Russia and draw it closer together with Europe. In fact, what it did, it made Europe extremely vulnerable to Russia, something that the Russians very much No, and the calculation in Russia, it appears to be, you know, we can take more. These Europeans are weak because these are democratic societies. They have to explain to their voters every couple of years, you know, why the energy bill has gone up so much. Especially, summer, in Latvia where I am, you have 20% inflation right now. In the UK, is one of the few countries that isn't subsidizing these huge energy bills. So you're seeing a lot of small businesses, even, in the summer, already going out of business when they get hit with the bills in the country that is, relatively not very dependent on Russian gas. And I think that is very much what Putin is hoping for, is that, if you look at everything that Putin has said and done, you don't do this, for a joke. Like, you don't do this unless you're extremely committed to the bit. It's the same with Dugin. Dugin started out as this postmodernist. Everything that he would say would also contain its own denial. Half of it appeared to be a joke. So much of it was just, gibberish and trolling. But he's really become, committed to the bit. Like,
he's a homicidal.
And I think Putin is not unreasonably thinking that, he has stronger resolve than all these people. He doesn't really seem to respect most European leaders, and he thinks that he can outlast them. He's already been there for 22 years. Why should he stop now?
Yeah, understandable. Max, great to see you. Thank you as always. Everyone should read your stuff at the Financial Times. Everyone should follow you on Twitter. You're a great follow. Just want everyone to know that, and I really appreciate it.
All right. Okay. Thanks so much.
Thanks again to Max for joining the show. Always a great, the guy knows a lot about Russia, the ultra-nationalists.
Yes.
His head lives in dark spaces.
He really helped us, at the outset of the war, and just, he was right. Everything he said about, Putin's mindset in the run-up to the war, and, I think Max has got his finger on the pulse.
I do, too, in part because it seems like he was reading a lot of, Alexander Dugin philosophy, and he knew
I think
these
he goes deep
thinkers
yeah.
were
yeah he goes into it it's pretty it's, there's some it's interesting to look at the intellectual underpinnings of Putin such as they are, it's kind of
interesting is one word adjacent. Terrifying is another.
Thanks to Santa Marin, and thanks to the guy who wrote the review of the Jared Kushner book.
You're the best.
Maybe you should Google that.
I think his name is Dwight Garner.
Yeah, you should check it out. I was disappointed to see Jared at number one on Amazon. If you've made it this far, you can pick up my book and, make a little
knock him off. Yeah. Don't we think that Jared paid somebody to buy a bunch of bulk ones on Amazon?
I am 100% certain that Jared had people buying thousands and copies of his book.
Yeah, me too.
Because who else is? I mean, that review made the point. Who's this book for? Who are the Jared stans? It's not the MAGA people really like Jared.
Trump ain't reading this thing.
Yeah.
I don't think Ivanka's reading this.
Ivanka's not reading this thing.
Don and Eric can barely read.
Probably nobody is reading this who doesn't have to read it for their job.
No, absolutely not. All right, that's it for this week. Talk to you soon.
See ya.
Pod Save the World is a Crooked Media production. The executive producer is Michael Martinez. Our producer is Haley Muse. Saul Rubin is our associate producer. It's mixed and edited by Andrew Chadwick. Kyle Seglin is our sound engineer. Thanks to our digital team, Elijah Cohn, Phoebe Bradford, Milo Kim, and Amelia Montooth, who upload our episodes and videos at youtube.com/crookedmedia. If you guys like Pod Save America, please consider subscribing to our Friends of the Pod program. So Friends of the Pod get lots of stuff. You get more Pod Save America. That includes our new show, which is called Pod Save America Only Friends.
It's where Dan gets naked.
Where Dan gets full frontal nudity, but mostly it's a bi-weekly subscription-exclusive podcast that is basically Pod Save America, but behind a paywall. So it's a little bit looser and more fun. And it's Lovett and Favreau and me and Pfeiffer and then other Crooked hosts. We go deeper on the news and cover more stories. You also get Open Tabs, which is a weekly behind-the-scenes newsletter from the show. Plus, you get ad-free episodes of your favorite Crooked podcasts and all kinds of other stuff. Dan will come to your house and clean it once every quarter.
Yeah, clothes.
Dan is very busy, clothes only. But along with just getting great content, becoming a friend of the pod, joining our subscription community, is the number one thing you can do to help us grow, to help independent progressive media. So if you've ever thought about doing it, if you ever wanted more Pod Save America, consider going to crooked.com/friends and becoming a friend of the pod.